Our next case this morning is number 014002, William Cabrera against Charles L. Hindley. Ms. Ostenberg.
May it please the court, counsel, good morning. My name is Domenica Osterberger. I'm an assistant Illinois attorney general and I represent the warden in this cause. We are the appellant. Today I am asking this court to revisit its approach to Stone versus Powell's exception to the ban on the consideration of Fourth Amendment claims on habeas review.
If I may interrupt, albeit so early in your presentation.
Sure.
You are taking the position that in order to prevail, you must we indeed must change the law of the circuit. Am I correct?
I'm not.
Okay, the law of clarify that, because I must say, in reading your brief, I was under the impression that you did not agree with our approach to Stone against Powell's exception, and were asking us to change the law of the circuit.
I indeed am asking you to change the law of the circuit, Your Honor, but I also included an argument that under this court's current three-part test, the appellant should prevail. So, with the court's permission, I would like to focus first upon my argument that this court should change its approach to the exception, and then I will discuss my position as to the three-part test.
You give me a good roadmap of where you're going. Go ahead.
Okay.
Could sure. I come into that roadmap? Because you seem to be arguing that even a sham opportunity to litigate is sufficient to bar federal review under Stone versus Powell. And my question is, how can that be what the Supreme Court intended? It seems here that the lower state court simply got the facts wrong, and the prosecution conceded those errors at each step of the way, and then the Illinois Supreme Court relied on speculation. And what I'm trying to get to is, in what sense would that be a full and fair opportunity to litigate?
The crux of my argument regarding this approach, to this court's current approach to Stone versus Powell, Your Honor, is frankly that this court's approach focuses on the quality of the individual suppression hearing, which is something that Your Honor has alluded to in your question. I don't agree with some of the statements in your question regarding the fairness, particular fairness of this individual hearing, and in fact, that goes to my argument that under this court's three-part test that we should win. But getting back to my original point about the focus on the quality of the individual hearing, I am indeed suggesting to Your Honor that it matters not under Stone versus Powell what the quality of the individual suppression hearing was. And I'm saying that because I would submit that the focus of the Supreme Court in Stone should be upon the availability, the systemic procedure, the availability of a procedure by which to fully and fairly litigate a claim. So in other words, a mechanism that exists.
No matter how poorly that mechanism is employed.
In a particular individual case, yes.
How long would you deal with the Supreme Court citation in Stone to the Townsend case?
Well, the courts have been grappling with the Supreme Court citation to Townsend for almost 25 years, Your Honor. There's a CF reference to it. It's a CF reference without any parentheticals, without any explanation as to what Townsend
should
mean.
Doesn't even conform to the Blue Book, does it?
No, I was just going to say that. I dusted off my Blue Book, but I'm not about to suggest that the late Justice Powell didn't comply with his Blue Book properly. But that does mean something, because there is no explanation. And when one uses a CF reference, one would think that that would be an explanation as to why we're looking for some type of analogy to be drawn to a particular case. I would suggest to the court this, that the court's reference to Townsend was a reference to their envisioning a system that existed under which a full and fair evidentiary hearing could take place. Which brings me back to my original point, which is that it's not so outrageous for me to suggest to this court that habeas is an inappropriate place for you to look to the individual quality of a suppression hearing.
If I can interrupt again, as you can imagine, this is creating some problem for us, this whole concept. Is this a just a two-category situation. We either opt for a view of the exception to Stone, where we can we just look at the availability of the procedural mechanism, or we choose a situation where we look at the quality, as you say, of the particular hearing. Or is this some kind of a continuum, where at some point the quality gets so bad that it really wasn't an adequate opportunity? Is there a midway point, in other words, between these two conceptual extremes?
There might be a midway point, but I would suggest that that would operate under the system that I proposed to the court, which is to focus on the availability of a mechanism. Because my suggestion to the court is that for a habeas defendant to successfully be able to litigate a Fourth Amendment claim, he would have to establish that there's some type of systemic problem in the litigation of Fourth Amendment claims in the trial court system, or in the state court system. In other words, show that there's some type of, perhaps a statute that short-circuits an availability to have an evidentiary hearing, or perhaps, I would admit that it would be highly unusual and very difficult to show, but perhaps a long-standing pattern of misconduct on the part of the state court in litigating. But as to, my point, I guess, is, and if I'd like to say this, my point as to why we shouldn't focus on the individual aspect of the hearing is that that doesn't do anything to serve the deterrent purpose.
Well, suppose you had a downright cranky state court judge who just said, I know under state procedure, counsel, I'm supposed to give you a hearing on this suppression motion, but I'm not going to do it, and that's the end of it.
Appeal it.
Okay, and let's say the state appellate structure boots that. They just don't acknowledge the problem, and that is within the realm of possibility.
It
is in Illinois, but it's in the realm of possibility generally. What do you do now?
Appeal it. Take a cert petition. Because habeas is not, we're forgetting for a moment that your Fourth Amendment claim is not a protection of your individual Fourth Amendment rights. The only reason why we have an exclusionary rule is for a future benefit of society in order to provide a deterrent effect to police officers and government agents in taking away your Fourth Amendment rights. Nobody has ever suggested that the exclusionary rule serves to vindicate any particular error that happened in the case before the court. The error that occurred is already done. We're talking about a prospective deterrent, and that's a cost-benefit analysis of the exclusionary rule. We have said that society is willing to take the situation in which some of the most relevant evidence available for prosecuting a defendant is suppressed and not used to prosecute the defendant, which frankly can thwart the purpose of a trial, which is to search for the truth. But our society is willing to take that risk and willing to say we're not going to use that evidence because we feel that it's more important to provide a deterrent system to protect our Fourth Amendment rights.
Let me take you to a problem that I have, and it's this. Certainly by the time this case came to federal court, you were aware of a gap in the record regarding what the officers knew.
I'm sorry, I missed the what record, Your Honor?
You were aware of the gap.
Okay.
Yeah, the gap in the record. Regarding what the officers knew at the time of the arrest. Why didn't you at least submit an affidavit from the officers or from the police department about standard procedures at that time? Why should we now blame Cabrera, for this gap in the record?
I would suggest that there is a gap in the record that's entirely blamable, if that's the word, that we can entirely blame upon Cabrera, and that's his failure to litigate this properly in the trial court, which is one of the reasons, getting back to Your Honor's original question, why I think we went under this three-part test, because the court's three-part test requires the petitioner to have fully presented, it's basically a fair presentment position. The petitioner has to present the facts of his claim and the legal argument to the state court. Cabrera didn't do that. Because what had happened was, at the suppression hearing itself, there's no question that the officers testified with respect to generalities. That is, that Cabrera was part of a group of people who passed this forged check. And the parties accepted that. There's no question that the trial judge accepted that in his ruling. The attorney accepted that. The prosecutor referred to that fact. Ultimately, at trial, the manager of the store at which the check was passed testified. He testified, in fact, to a much more specific incident at the store, and what he testified to was that it was Lopez, the co-defendant, who in fact pulled the check out, pulled out the fake ID that he had the victim's name put into it for. So I guess my point to you is this. Illinois law provided for the defendant at that time to say, wait a minute, I want to relitigate my suppression claim on the basis of this testimony. He didn't do it.
But the Illinois Supreme Court found that he properly preserved the issue, and they addressed it on the merits, suggesting that the state courts were aware of the issue and could have taken further evidence.
I would disagree with that interpretation of the Illinois Supreme Court's ruling, Your Honor, because there's no question he preserved a probable cause issue. He litigated a Payton versus New York issue. But what he didn't litigate was this change in testimony issue, which brings me to my point of, isn't the determination of probable cause based upon what is reasonably known to the police officer at the time of the arrest? There is no information in this record, unfortunately, from which we can learn what the reasonable belief of the officers were with respect to what they knew that the defendant had done at the time that they had arrested him.
And yet the Illinois Supreme Court draws a reasonable inference about what the officers knew at the time of arrest. And I don't know what fact that inference is based on. And, of course, I worry about all the cases to come where, you know, the inferences could be whatever they infer the inferences are.
I have two responses to that. Number one is, this case was decided in 1987, which was 16 years ago, so I would suggest that if there was some type of bad effort that was going to be relied upon by the Illinois Supreme Court, they would have done so by now. We don't really have any cases in which that was relied upon to this extent. But secondly, the inference that Your Honor is referring to with respect to the Illinois Supreme Court's probable cause ruling was not an inference as to what the reasonable belief of the officer was as to what Cabrera's particular activity was in the store. What the inference was that the Illinois Supreme Court drew, which then supported their probable cause finding, was with respect to the criminal history and its availability to the police officers. And what the Illinois Supreme Court had concluded was, we don't have to look at the particular probable cause argument that the defendant raised, or petitioner, I should say, that is the change in testimony based upon Derek Moore's testimony, because we think there are other inferences in the record that in and of themselves support probable cause, so we don't need to get to your issue. And they said, we know that he's got a burglary arrest, we know he's got an attempt burglary conviction, he's got other arrests, his rap sheet's in the record, it's very clear that that's all in there. We are going to reasonably infer here that the police officers were well aware of his criminal history, and that being aware of his criminal history in that area and him shopping in the manner that was suggested to by the testimony, that was sufficient for the officers to believe that he, in fact, had been guilty of passing the forged check along with Lopez. That was their reasonable inference. It was not a reasonable inference about what the officers reasonably believed. And that's important because ultimately the probable cause determination has to turn on what they reasonably believed, and the defendant or the petitioner just didn't litigate that, which means that the first part of this court's three-part test, if you don't accept my argument that there's a systemic, there should be a systemic approach to the exception, we should win under this court's first part of this court's test because the petitioner didn't present these facts. We should also win under the second part because, frankly, all the district court did here was disagree with the inference that was drawn by the Illinois Supreme Court, which then supported their probable cause finding. And that simply doesn't suffice to pierce Stone versus Powell. I see that I'm already into my rebuttal time. I would be happy to answer any further questions by this court. Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. We'll hear now from Mr. Wong.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the Court, I'd like to proceed immediately to the Stone issue, and as a roadmap, I'd like to offer that I'd like to first go through the three-part test, and then I'd like to address my learned colleague, Ms. Osterberger's arguments regarding the extension of Hampton or the correction of Hampton such that this Court would look to a mechanism as opposed to merely the test that was articulated in Stone. Under the three-part test that was established by the Seventh Circuit and which has been in constant use throughout the history of this court, the petitioner first has to fairly inform clearly the state court of the factual basis for his claim. As I believe one of Judge Rovner's questions indicated, the state court did address it, and in fact, the Illinois Supreme Court explicitly stated that the record adequately shows that the defendant deserved, for appeal, the issue of probable cause. This is located at the Illinois Supreme Court's decision at 508 Northeast 2nd, 712. The second prong of the three-part test is whether the state court has clearly and thoroughly analyzed the facts. And here, the district court found that the state court did not do that. What the record here shows is that the trial court initially found that there was probable cause on the belief that Mr. Cabrera was the one that tendered the traveler's checks and the false ID. As my colleague indicated during her argument, that was not true. It was Ruben Lopez, his friend, who was doing it. And in fact, the store manager who testified indicated that Mr. Cabrera wasn't even near the cash register at the time. He was walking around with the third person that was in the group around the store looking for stuff. We come to the Illinois Intermediate Appellate Court's decision, and they abandoned the rationale that was proposed by the trial court. Instead, what they rely on is the belief that the police officers actually knew of Mr. Cabrera's arrest record at the time of the arrest. That, too, was later conceded by the state before the Illinois Supreme Court to be untrue. And therefore, we already have this moving target where the state courts continually change the facts. When we come to the Illinois Supreme Court, I would suggest that the facts on this case having been exhausted, the Illinois Supreme Court made not an inference, but rather an assumption of what the facts must have been. An inference, and the difference between this is that an inference is a belief that is tethered by logic to some basis in the record. An assumption is one that is not. And in this case, the Illinois State Court said that the investigating officers certainly would have examined the Chicago Police Department records. And the other quote that comes from that decision is that at the time of the defendant's arrest, it must be reasonably concluded that the detectives ascertained the information appearing in the Chicago Police Department records.
You said the Intermediate Appellate Court did really assume that. Actually happened, but that was shown not to be true. Is there evidence in the record that in fact the officers did not check the record?
Yes, in the Illinois Supreme Court decision, the dissent of I believe it's Justice Simon gave a factual recitation of the arguments that were presented at the court, and the dissent indicates that the state conceded it is not in the record what the police officers actually knew at the time they arrested Mr. Cabrera.
So they might have or they might not have.
They might have or they might not. The record doesn't say either way.
And the Supreme Court said, look, on the evidence we have before us, we assume they did. They had the mugshot. Mugshot obviously came from a record. Police officer would have checked the record.
There's actually two assumptions in that. One is that having looked at the mugshot, there would be a standard procedure by which the police officers would have consulted criminal history. And then following that is the assumption that the police officers actually did go about doing that. In this case, we think that the assumption is not tethered to the record for that reason and is not reasonable because in this particular case, that is the only thing that gives rise to the existence of probable cause. If state courts were permitted to go and assume the one material fact which gives rise to probable cause, it would be unnecessary to make those determinations. We can just do it by assumption, and that can't possibly be right. And I point out that that isn't right according to a decision which was cited by the district court during these habeas proceedings and which the state has only mentioned in its brief but has not appealed from. And that decision is Beck versus Ohio. In Beck, an informant had advised the police that the defendant was engaged in some sort of gambling activity. The informant advised the police of what the petitioner looked like and advised the police, I believe, that he had a criminal record. In any case, the police in fact did know, as a fact, that he had a criminal record. The Supreme Court of the United States has held that that wasn't enough to give rise to probable cause. And in fact, the decision contained the admonition that to hold that knowledge of either or both petitioner's physical appearance and previous record constituted probable cause would be to hold that anyone with a previous criminal record could be arrested at will. And we believe that taking that admonition to heart, the Illinois Supreme Court both erred as a matter of the facts as well as on the law in making the assumption that it did. And therefore, Mr. Cabrera did not get a full and fair hearing before the state courts. I turn to the argument that this court should use a state procedural mechanism as the touchstone for determining whether there has been a full and fair hearing. I believe that the Seventh Circuit's interpretation of Stone has been consistently correct. The specific language that comes out of Stone versus Powell is an opportunity for a full and fair litigation. This expression is punctuated by a footnote which refers to Townsend. My colleague, Ms. Archerberger, indicates that the footnote is merely a CF footnote, and therefore perhaps lesser weight might be attributed to it. But I point out that Townsend is a curious case, and one reads Townsend, one realizes that that Townsend is not an accident. In Townsend, the facts were that the petitioner had been arrested, and he was a heroin addict. Because he was suffering from withdrawal, the police doctor gave him a drug which was to lessen the effects of the withdrawal. It turns out that the medication that was given to him was also known to be a truth serum. And so there was some question as to the voluntariness of the confession that he gave almost immediately after being administered the drug. And what the Supreme Court held was that in determining whether the district court needed to grant an evidentiary hearing, the district court needed to determine whether there was a full and fair opportunity to litigate the issue of the voluntariness. And to that end, the Supreme Court in Townsend gave a list of six factors which were to determine what it meant to have a full and fair hearing. I think that the facts on that case and the disposition of that case clearly shows that those six factors are to be used to construe what the term full and fair litigation means.
As I listened to you and as I read your brief, the note I made to myself was, if we accept that view of the exception in Stone, don't we really eat the major holding of Stone? Don't we destroy the major holding of Stone? What is the limit on our ability then to scrutinize a finding of probable cause or a lack of finding of probable cause by a state court? It seems to me that every time there's any kind of factual inaccuracy, no matter how small it is, habeas court's going to find an excuse to go ahead and entertain the Fourth Amendment issue.
That's a well-taken point, Your Honor, and I believe that the answer to that is that where the facts are wrong to the extent that it appears that there has not been a full and fair litigation of the Fourth Amendment claim, then the Stone criteria are satisfied. That is, the Stone-Townsend criteria are satisfied.
And what is not the full and fair hearing here? Is it the fact that the Supreme Court of Illinois relied on this what you believe is speculation as to the fact the officers in all likelihood did look up the man's record? Or is it the moving target that bounced through the Illinois system?
Both, Your Honor. On the totality of this record, both of them give rise to an inference that there was not a full and fair hearing. Certainly there was as you say, the moving target problem, which is that the facts keep on changing on Mr. Cabrera. So that would have been the first problem. And then when we finally come to the Illinois Supreme Court, having found no other facts that could be used to sustain the finding of probable cause, it comes up with an assumption which is contrary to clearly established Supreme Court precedent and is not found anywhere in the record. I And to that end, I believe that the circumstances here meet even the high standard that was established in Hampton. In Hampton, this court said that the principle behind the Stone holding is that we are to determine whether the state courts had closed their minds to the Fourth Amendment claims. I submit to the court that where the state continually changes the rationale for its Fourth Amendment finding, and not only that, but changes it in such a manner that the state had to concede that the corrections were necessary, I would say that there has not been a full and fair finding.
Mr. Long, I don't want to dictate how you spend your time, and I'll certainly defer to my colleagues if they have other priorities, but I know I would appreciate your at least addressing briefly the sufficiency of the evidence issue. It seems to me there are two lines of cases in the Illinois Supreme Court, and it just preferred to follow one rather than the other. I'm having a hard time seeing what we federal types can do about that.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I thank you for the segue into the sufficiency argument. I don't believe that there are two lines of authority. There's actually a fairly consistent line of authority here. In Zuniga, which is the principal case on which the warden relies, there were significantly different facts, materially different facts. There, the break-in occurred during the early evening. Here, in the case at Barr, the break-in occurred at 11:30 at night. The significance of the time of the break-in is that it is more reasonable to assume that people would be at a place during early evening than, say, at 11:30 at night.
A locked church, though.
It was a locked church. It was actually a church complex which consisted of a rectory, a courtyard which connected the rectory, and the church itself, which gives even a greater force to an inference that someone would be in the church. It's just across the way from where the personnel for the church would live. In this case, the foundation, that is the office, is not attached to any sort of dwelling. There would not be any basis for a reasonable inference that someone would be inside at 11:30 at night when the doors are locked and the lights are out. The court in Zuniga also found that there was an appearance of an ambush based on the fact that the priest who entered the church was attacked almost immediately upon his entry, and that it wasn't that he had gone in there and startled someone. In this case, there is no such evidence.
Is it enough if the perpetrator has the intent to commit the crime should he encounter someone? Suppose the defendant, in other words, said, "I'm going in there, I'm going to hit this place, I'm certainly going to commit theft inside. And if there happens to be somebody in there, he's a target too. I don't know whether there is or there isn't, but if there's somebody there, I'm in a mood to take him down too." Is that enough?
I think that would be a closer case, and I think that might be enough, but the facts on this case are distinguishable in that Mr. Cabrera had no such intent. He had no knowledge that anyone was in there, and therefore the record doesn't give rise to any indication that he had an intent to go and
but
commit robbery.
But need to have the knowledge that someone's in there. Can he just simply say, somebody might be in there? It doesn't make any. It is completely immaterial to me whether I'm going to have to confront somebody or not. I'm going in there and I'm going to do what I have to do to get whatever's valuable, whether it's from the place or the person. I don't care.
Mm-hmm. It would turn actually. The answer is found in your question. It would turn exactly on whether there is a reasonable expectation that someone is in there. If you go into if he had gone into an empty place where it would be expected that someone was in there and he had a conscious belief that he was going to go and rob whoever was in there at the time, then I think, yes, it is possible, although I don't know what the Illinois authorities say on this particular point. But in this case, he could not have manifested that intent because he didn't know that anybody was in there. And the record doesn't give any indication or give any basis for an inference for him to manifest or to form that intent. And I finally point out that the correct standard of review before this court is clear error. The district court found...
Did the district court conduct hearings in this case or merely review the cold record?
No, the district court merely reviewed the cold record.
So why should we defer to those findings?
The district court's review of the cold record was a factual finding. It was a factual finding that there was clear and convincing evidence that the state court record was devoid of any basis from which it could have made the assumption.
Aren't we in an equally good position to review the record?
That appears to be the argument that was made by my colleague, and the citation that I believe she gave to it was Neal versus Berger. In that case, though, even the Supreme Court did not stray from the clear error standard. There, the Supreme Court reviewed the record in the same way and said it would have been equally competent, but it did not do so. It did not establish a more generous type of review. I see my time's expired unless I could be of further assistance.
Thank you, Mr. Wall.
Thank you.
How much time is Ms. Ostenberger? We're going to, let's make that, we had some questions for your opponent. Let's make that an even 3 minutes so that you can adequately address the issues.
I guess I'll start with the last point, which was the clear error argument. I outlined in my reply brief in fair detail as to why I disagree with my opponent's position with respect to that. It seems to me that what he's doing is taking disagreements with the factual inferences upon which the Illinois Supreme Court made its probable cause finding and trying to equate those into factual findings that are should be afforded clear deference. That would be contrary to the habeas and the habeas review if this had been reviewed or if this should be reviewed under the statute, but certainly under the constraints of the viewing the exception to Stone versus Powell. My opponent also seems to confuse the court's ultimate determination with respect to the habeas claim as something that should be reviewed for clear error. And that, as I've outlined in my reply brief, I think is simply wrong. If there are no further questions on the clear error argument, I just wanted to touch on a few more points that he had mentioned. I never got to the second issue in my argument. My argument is, in fact, that the Illinois Supreme Court adequately found that the defendant possessed the appropriate felonious intent when he entered into the building. Your Honor, it touched upon the question of whether or not Illinois law prevents a finding of the intent along the lines of, if somebody might be in here, I'm going to commit a robbery against them. Frankly, I don't know that Illinois law does prevent that, and I think that's really one of my arguments to you, which is that it's clear that you can look to the activity that took place in the building to support a conclusion about what the intent was in entering the building. And my argument to the court was that the brutality, the heinous brutality of the murder of the victim in this case, along with the rummaging through his possessions in addition to the general burglary of the premises itself, would support the conclusion that they did indeed possess the intent to commit a robbery therein. And so on those factual grounds, I think that the district court wrongly disagreed with the state court. As well, I cited, I believe, in a supplemental authority, the Supreme Court's recent decision, Woodford versus Viciotti, which I think really almost takes care of another concern of the district court. Woodford, in essence, teaches us that a verbatim summary of the standard to be applied is not necessary, and that the federal courts will, in fact, presume that the state courts know what the standards are. I cited in my brief the fact that in 1985, in People versus Collins, the Illinois courts adopted the Jackson standard. The fact that it wasn't quoted verbatim in this particular case, I would suggest, does not render this a contrary to decision. Certainly, the suggestion that evidence improbable or unsatisfactory, which creates a reasonable doubt, is not something which would suggest that the Illinois Supreme Court applied some type of lesser standard here. So, frankly, I think this court has to reverse the district court's decision on the second issue.
Ms. Ostenberger, that is the end.
Okay. I wasn't sure if that was the 3 minutes or the 1 minute, but I apologize. Are there further questions?
I gather not. Well, Ms. Ostenberger and Mr. Wong, when the court gets a difficult case, we always hope we're going to find that we have very good lawyers in front of us to argue it, and today we did. We thank both of you for all of your help in both your briefs and in the oral argument. Mr. Wong, you